It doesn't have to be triple smart to do what it does.
Just instinct, then?
Instinct is plenty when you're that fast and that mean.
With the corridor's end in plain sight, they could no longer travel in a straight line. They had to weave around and between the litter of bodies and puddles. On the right was a single closed door. It had a small window reinforced with wire mesh. The torchlight wouldn't penetrate to the other side.
Could be it.
JB took hold of the knob, and as he opened the door, Ryan swept in with torch in one fist and Galil in the other. The stairwell landing was clear of demons, but the stench of death was even more oppressive than in the hall. It had substance, and it had weight. The weight of numbers.
I think we've got ourselves a chilling ground. There's got to be a whole lot of bodies below us. That thing wasn't waiting to ambush victims out in the hall. It was getting the lion's share of them in here. The ones that made it to the corridor, it probably chased down from behind.
If there's just the one and we can get past it or through it, we might get to the bottom.
Based on that stink, the odds aren't very good.
Well, at least it's a tighter space than the hallway. That gives it less room to use its speed to maneuver, and us a better chance to hit it and show it.
What do you say, Wicklaw? Ready to go for two?
It was the pilgrim's turn not to laugh. The sight and smell of the corpses and pools of acid had turned his face pale under the beard. He covered his nose and mouth with his free hand. His eyes were watering.
What's wrong, big man? Don't care for the perfume? You're responsible for some of it.
And now he's on the verge of becoming perfume himself.
Funny how things turn out.
Jubilee, take hold of my shirt. All right, people, let's do this.
Ryan and JB started down side by side, filling the stairway from rail to wall. They held their torches as high as they could and aimed their drawn weapons down the stairs in front of them. The lower they descended, the stronger the stench became. By the time they reached the next landing, they had to breathe through their mouths to keep from puking. On the stairs behind them, Wicklaw wasn't so fortunate. Then, the grin-wounded man caught the vomit bug.
Could you two triple stoops make any more noise if you tried?
It doesn't matter, JB. We're not gonna sneak up on this bastard anyway. It already knows we're coming. This is its prime hunting ground.
Evidence of what it hunted appeared below them, at the flickering verge of the torchlight. Stripped human skeletons lay stretched out along the stairs. At least a half dozen of them. Some lay belly down, some belly up. Their clothing had been torn off and hurled aside. Some were missing one or both legs. As Ryan and JB stepped between the ruined bodies, the air had a heat to it. The abrasive heat of decay.
Wait, another blaster!
JB bent down, and using the muzzle of the llama, nudged a pistol butt from the edge of the slime. From the shape of the grip, it looked like a heavy-caliber semi-auto. And it was. But the Beretta 92's action was fully locked back. Looking into the breech, he could see the magazine's floor plate. The last round had been fired.
Shit!
JB kicked the empty blaster aside. It wasn't worth wiping the slime off. They continued down to the next landing, where the bodies were so thick it was difficult to step around them, and the pools of slime. The skeletons lay one on top of the other. Most were face down, caught from behind as they tried to crawl away. Based on the weapons and capabilities he'd seen, Ryan figured the demon's first pass was a hit and run, intended to blindside and incapacitate its victims. Then it followed up at its leisure.
It's still below us, not far now.
Carter held his torch out as far as he could reach. He couldn't see down to the plane of the next landing. He could see bodies on the stairs, though. Slower runners than the ones up above.
These things can leap, remember. It probably won't come running up the steps at us. Chances are it'll jump high, maybe along the ceiling, and drop down on top of us.
Gotcha.
They descended more slowly, step by step, in unison, pausing, listening. There were no clicks, no scraping noises. Gradually, their torchlight illuminated the landing. The bodies were piled high there, too, but there was no sign of the demon. They couldn't see around the turn in the staircase until they stepped off onto the landing. This one had a door in it. JB opened it, and Ryan stuck his head, torch, and assault rifle through. Before him was a dank, dark corridor, like the one they had just left. Like the hallway above, it was decorated with human remains. Ryan listened for sounds of movement, but all he could hear was his heart pounding in his throat. He carefully drew back.
Just another access corridor. Still too high up.
No sign of the damn thing?
Guess it's lower.
Wicklaw and the Gren wounded man tiptoed around the bodies on the landing, keeping their backs to the stairwell wall.
We have to keep going, you two.
Sure. Whatever you say, Ryan.
Jubilee took hold of Ryan's shirt. He stepped down onto the next flight of stairs.
They're right on top of us!
Where is it?
JB raised his torch, scanning the stairs above and the stairs below. With the echo in the stairwell, it was impossible to vector in on the source of the noise. It came from everywhere at once. Everyone was looking around frantically, and no one was seeing the obvious. It was right under their noses.
Oh, fuck! Abominator, stay...
Shut the fuck up, Wicklaw!
Ryan saw it first. A darker area in the landing wall, to the right of where Wicklaw and the other man were standing. Elliptical in shape. In its center was a wet spot, seeping yellow. Ryan swung Jubilee around behind him.
Look out! It's in the wall!
Wicklaw immediately jumped for the stairs above, but the Gren wounded man made the mistake of turning and looking at the dark spot not 4 feet away. He froze, eyes wide with fear.
Oh my God!
Ryan averted his eye and shielded his face with a forearm. He already had the Galil up, muzzle pointing in the direction of the hole. But things were happening faster than he could react. As he lowered his arm, he glimpsed a sleek brown shape vaulting, long legs extended from the gash. It hit the landing and jumped to the stairs above before Ryan could fire. The Gren wounded man slammed against the rear wall, as if sideswiped by a runaway wag, his arms flung wide and loose. Even though Ryan knew what was coming next, he still couldn't track the beast. And he didn't dare fire the Galil blind into a wall 10 feet away. The full-auto ricochets would have cut him and JB to pieces. JB had his pistol up, too. But when the time came, he couldn't fire either. It was over too quickly. No hesitation. A clean grab, a clean re-entry. Start to finish, it took maybe 3 seconds. No one said anything for a long moment. They were too astonished by the turn of events. JB used his gun hand to thumb his glasses back up the bridge of his nose and let out the breath of air he had been holding.
Bob and Enid protect us.
The acid spatter had burnt holes in the back of Wicklaw's robe and in his skanky, felted mass of hair.
We are doomed.
Mildred, Christy, Jack, and Doc abandoned the redoubt's elevator and ran for the stairs, back the way they had come. When they reached the above-ground floor, Jack led them through the security checkpoint to the inner airlock door, where the clanging was the loudest. He put his hand to the metal, then pulled it back.
Feel it, Christy.
When she touched the door, she could feel the shock of the impact through her fingertips.
Are they trying to break down the outer door? Are they using a battering ram?
That would be a waste of effort. Vanadium steel can turn back a direct hit from a cannon shell.
There are too many impacts, too erratically spaced. It cannot be a battering ram.
Then they must be rolling the boulders down onto the door. They're barricading us in.
It appears we won't be using that exit in the near future.
The pilgrims don't want to have to bother guarding the entrance. This solves the problem for them.
And makes our situation that much worse. Even if the redoubt's MAT transunit is in working order, we can't go back to rescue Ryan and JB now.
Not the way we came in, at any rate.
Stick to the plan.
Jack's right. We have to address and solve one problem at a time, and in the order we have already agreed upon. This regrettable turn of events has not altered our priorities. We have to know whether we are in fact trapped here. And once we have determined that to our satisfaction, we can explore our options.
At least this means they won't be coming in after us.
We have all the time in the world. Unfortunately, the same cannot be said for our dear friends.
They hurriedly returned to the floor below and the service elevator. After brushing aside the dense mat of cobwebs that draped from the ceiling, they climbed in. When Christy pushed the buttons for floor numbers 10 and 18, the door slid shut. The interior lights flickered, the car jerked, and they began a descent so sickeningly rapid they had to steady themselves on the walls.
Come on, Jack. Let's find that MAT trans unit.
Uh-huh.
Doc and I will be down on 18. When you're done up here, come down and find us.
Good luck.
Same back. What do you really think about our chances, Doc?
My honest opinion?
That's what I asked for.
At this point, I'm afraid it looks dire for all of us, my dear. Dire indeed.
What we need is a break. Ever since we mat-transed, things have gone from bad to worse. Then again, why should this place be any different from any other?
Yes, a turn of luck would be most welcome.
On floor 18, the doors opened onto another security checkpoint. It was the mirror image of the setup at the redoubt entrance. There was a holding cell, and the firing ports and the armored glass of the sec station faced the elevator and the hallway on the other side of the cell, designed to prevent both break-ins and break-outs. As they cleared the holding cell, through the open sliding window of the security installation, they could see more evidence of a sudden departure. There were paper coffee cups on the desk. The brown liquid they had contained had long since evaporated. Beside the cups were four paper plates that had once held food. Whatever the SEC crew's last meal had been, it had turned to pillowy mounds of bluish mold, which had spread as far as it could across the desktop before dying many decades past. As Mildred and Doc walked by the window, the faint currents of air they stirred up caused the fragile mounds to collapse in on themselves, raising clouds of gray-blue dust. On either side of the corridor were red and yellow signs. Caution, biohazard. Caution, radiation area. Set in the wall of the intersecting hallway directly ahead was a long, heavily gasketed window. On the other side of it, banks of fluorescent lights blinked erratically, illuminating the corridor beyond, and another gasketed window. On the far side of the second window, there appeared to be another hallway, and another after that, and perhaps another still, although the glare bouncing back and forth between the windows made it difficult to be sure of the actual number.
What, pray tell, is all this for?
It looks like a bioengineering facility. Pre-Armageddon, state-of-the-art, ultra-secure quarantine. Each of the barriers we're looking at is a biohazard containment level. The sealed enclosures are boxes inside of boxes. From the gaskets on the windows, they're probably reverse pressurized, which acts as a failsafe against accidental release of dangerous material. If one box breaks, the atmosphere flows in instead of out, and there are still four more enclosures to contain the spill.
A very complex quarantine regimen. What was the dangerous material that required such care?
Mead and Schumer's published work was on the use of non-living vectors to transfer specific snippets of genetic material. They would insert the new DNA sequences into viruses, which, when they infected the target cells, would splice in the desired instructional code.
If these viruses got loose, they could accidentally infect white coats and redoubt personnel?
Mm-hmm, that's right. And through the process of infection, the virus would transfer the new section of DNA code to every cell in victims' bodies. In an isolated, secure structure like this, dependent upon recycled air and a ventilation system, the escape of viral research material would mean an epidemic of unforeseen consequences. I'm guessing that's the kind of bioengineering operation that was going on here. It's the same application of technology that got them into trouble initially.
They followed the signs on the wall to the director's suite of offices. On the other side of a glass barrier, through automatic glass doors, was an anteroom, Berber carpeted, with a row of administrative assistance desks, blocking direct access to a pair of mahogany floor-to-ceiling doors. Bob and Enid's spacious adjoining offices were on the other side of the massive doors, separated from each other by a wall of glass. The U.S. government had spared no expense on the lab director's furnishings. Mead and Schumer, international outcasts of science, had cut themselves a very sweet deal. Not just leather-upholstered couches and vast executive desks. They had their own wet bars, private bathrooms, a connecting exercise suite complete with sauna and whirlpool. Mildred scanned the spines of the books that tightly packed a wall of shelves. She recognized the standard chemical and medical reference works. There were also tomes on veterinary medicine, cellular biology, cellular pathology, and virology. She waved Doc over to the suite's computer workstation. Thumbtacked to the bulletin board alongside the drive tower were a series of snapshots, greeting cards, and little notes. The photos were of Mead and Schumer, together and individually, with different background scenes. One looked like a European capital. Another was somewhere in the Far East. There was a mountaintop ski resort. Holiday photographs. Doc opened one of the greeting cards and read the inscription.
This would be Dr. Schumer's office, then.
Mildred looked over Tanner's shoulder. The card's corny, gushy, romantic sentiment was underscored by the cover's painting of a fluffy kitten with enormous eyes. It was signed, "To my dear one, all my love, Enid." The other card's printed sentiments were even gushier. They offered vows of love eternal, praised a perfect match of souls, proclaimed stolen hearts, and there were little personal notes, very affectionate, written in a tight, controlled, miniature hand. All were from Enid Mead.
Here's a different sort of greeting.
It was a new baby card, addressed to Bob. Inside, the word boy had been crossed out, and the sentence altered to read, "Congratulations, it's an it, and it's ours." It was signed, "Love Forever, Enid." Mildred didn't bother trying to start up the computer.